Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. My name is Kurt Wilson. I'm the Armchair Survivalist, and today is June the 27th in the year 2021. Welcome to the show. If you want to know all the different ways to listen to me, obviously you know at least one, because you're listening to me right now. But go to armchairsurvivalist.com, and all you do is scroll down any of the pages there. You scroll down to the bottom of the page, and you will see all the different ways that you can listen to me. I'm on every podcast venue that you can imagine. Well, let us see here. I'll go down here, and I'll read some of these things to you. Stitcher, Anchor, TuneIn, we're closing down YouTube. And by the way, any of you who listen to me on YouTube, stop it now. Because this week, everything's going to be deleted from there. They have threatened me, and they tell you you get three strikes and you're out, and I've had two strikes. And these strikes are simple strikes. When I read any article from the World Health Organization or the CDC or the National Institute of Health, any article I read from them is called misinformation. And this is how communists control communication. So I'm going to be closing down YouTube. Anyway, iHeartRadio, Google, Apple, just all kinds of weird stuff. I'm on Global Star 3 Satellite. You can pick me up on that. You can listen in my chat room. You go to armchairsurvivalist.com and click on chat room. You go there. You don't have to chat. You can listen. Or you can listen on your phone. Now, you just dial 641-741-0371. It's 641, area code, 741-0371. It's not toll-free, and it might not be the right number. Now, here's the thing. This is a free system. So, I get what I pay for. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. Most of the time it works. And if the number's not working, they'll give you another number that you can listen to. Now, if you miss the show and you want to download it, on the left-hand side of any of the pages at armchairsurvivalist.com, you'll see the little white nipper dog listening to the RCA Victor gramophone. You click on that. That'll take you to my archive page, where you will see all the different shows of the current year. I only leave 1 year up, and this the end of January or February of each year, I delete all of the previous years. So you want my shows, download them from there. All right, we've got some things to talk about here. Most of you don't know what a VPN is, a virtual private network. This is a security system. Basically, when you go online, you go on the internet, almost every government in the world knows you're on there. If they're looking for you, they can see you're on there. They can see who you're listening to. They can see what you're searching for. They can see anything you're doing, you're looking at, you're researching, you're visiting websites. They can see all of this stuff. Well, with a VPN service, you are kind of invisible. They don't know where you are. I'm in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. But when I turn on my VPN, I'm in Germany or Italy or Spain, or who knows? This depends on my mood, where I want to be from. And then they literally have no clue who I am. Now, there's no such thing as 100% anonymity. If they want you, they're going to find you one way or the other. But a VPN service is the best way for you to be anonymous when you're on the internet. And if you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, on the right-hand side towards the top, you will see the VPN service I use. You can click on it, and you can find out more about it. It's a very simple thing to do. It's a little program you download onto your computer, and when you just before you go on the internet, you don't have to use this every time. You don't have to use a VPN every time. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But you go on, you open the VPN up, and you click on. It's self-explanatory. You'll see all the instructions. You click on it, it gives it a few minutes or seconds, and then it says, "Okay, you're connected." And now everything you do on the internet is secure and safe. So I have that VPN at armchairsurvivalist.com. Go there and look at it. If you're interested in any VPN, that's the bit. Out of all the ones I have tried, never mind all the garbage you see on the internet and TV, the ads and such, this is the simplest one there is. And believe me, I want simple. I'm an idiot. I need to be able to do this kind of stuff without having to ask an 8-year-old child. Now, we also have food. Now, we used to be, until about 8 years ago, we were the second largest emergency food supplier in the United States. We closed that down because all the food companies, they went directly to the internet. You know, they bypassed the vendors. So there's no money in it. But we are still Mountain House master distributors. I have Mountain House Foods in here. Now, all I have are in the bucket. They're called an expedition. I will get it posted up, but it'll be on the chat room. I'll put the link in the chat room. I put links in the chat room when we're doing the show. Sometimes when I'm talking about something, I'll put the link to that article in the chat room. But I'll put the link to the Mountain House Foods in the show. If you go to survivalenterprises.com, SE1.US, you will see on the left-hand side, you scroll down, you'll see healthcare, personal care, water filters, and food stuff. Click on the food stuff, and that'll take you to links. One of them is a Mountain House. You click on that, and it'll show you what I've got. And now, it's 15 double-serving pouches. In other words, this is about a week's worth of food for one person. And the key behind Mountain House, they invented freeze-drying. So this food is all freeze-dried. It's real. It's not pretend. It's freeze-dried. And it has an oxygen absorber in each pouch. So each pouch is two servings. All right. This thing, you can store this up to 50 years, depending on how you store it. I know this for a fact because I worked with Mountain House and we were testing the long-term efficacy and taste and nutritional value of their product. Now, these a bucket of this, $150 delivered anywhere in the United States. If you come into the store in Hayden, Idaho, it's only $125 a bucket. We got to charge $25 a bucket for shipping. And speaking of shipping, you guys, you'd better get ready. Post office, FedEx, and UPS are raising their rates again. This is insane. But regardless, back to this Mountain House, $150 delivered anywhere in the United States. We have, and I've talked about this before, ham radios. Ham radios are transceivers, meaning you can transmit and receive. There's a learning curve to it. It's the training is available all over the internet. And before Karen died, we had many talks with her about using ham radios. They're not easy to get. I'm down to six, and I had almost 40 of them here in stock. And I can't get any more right now. I've got to wait for something to break loose so I can buy some more. But these things, they're $50 a piece. You aren't going to find a ham radio that cheap. Not a quality one at all. Now, these are Chinese, of course. What isn't nowadays? But they work beautifully. And they can kind of go out of band, is the term. Meaning, they have different frequencies. They can go, the amateur band, the FRS band, GMRS band, few other places they can go. I'm not going to talk about it on the air. But let's just say, if you want a ham radio, this is what you need. And you go to the survivalenterprises.com, SE1.US, and you do the scroll down thing on the left, and you'll see on sale. That's where you're going to find these. You click on that, and that'll take you to a page that has the stuff that's we're closing out, or it's on sale, or it's limited supply. You'll see on there the Voyager shortwave radio. Every person should have a shortwave radio. I don't care what you have. I don't care where you get it. Every person should have one. This one, it's got built-in batteries. You can charge them with a crank. You can charge it with a solar panel that's built in. You can put your own batteries in there. You can plug it in the wall and use it. And you can plug your cell phone into the back of this radio and crank and charge your cell phone up. So this is not only AM, FM, shortwave, and the NOAA emergency weather bands, but you can charge your cell phone with this thing. So that's there. And the ham radio are there. They're explained there. You can see what we got there. And I've got one for $50 and one for $75. We're out of the $75 one. So we're done with that. Now, that's for the business. Now, I want to talk about some personal things with me. As you know, I'm a patriot, and I have been for many, many, many years. I founded the Stanislaus County Militia. We were instrumental in saving people's lives and property during the Modesto flood. The FBI does not like me. They don't like any militias. They don't like Americans. The FBI is part of the deep state. Doesn't matter who the president is. I don't attend patriot meetings. I don't go to these meetings where we're doing this locker room rah-rah and how we need to stand up against the deep state and we need to, you know, fight or we just need to form groups that can help each other. I don't do any of that. And let me give you one example why. Many, many years ago, well, not many, many, maybe just many years ago, The National Rifle Association had two offices, one in Virginia and one in San Francisco, California. And that's it. And if you were an NRA member, you had no one to communicate to. You couldn't call up the NRA and say, hey, I got a question. Is this legal? Can I do this? Blah, blah, blah. So my brother and I founded this organization called Friends of the NRA. Now, a couple years later, it was taken away from us and given to two more politically correct brothers. And the NRA claims they founded it, but we didn't. They didn't. We did. My brother and I did. We had a meeting in Modesto, California, the first meeting. Now, we came out and we explained to all of our friends and on the radio that we want to set up chapters in every state where volunteers could have a small group where they can be questioned and help locals with gun questions. So that's what we did. Okay, so we had this meeting. There were 5,000 people there. That's a lot of parking spaces in Modesto, California. There were 5,000 people there, and everybody was rah-rah, sis-boom-bah. We're going to fight, and we're gonna take our Second Amendment rights back. And, I mean, it was great. And then the next month, we had another meeting, and there were 2,800 people there. And then we started to put together the idea of, okay, we need to have local chapters, and we can set up a chapter of Friends of the NRA in any city. So we started getting names and addresses and phone numbers of people who were willing to help us. So the next month we had another meeting, and there was 150 people showed up. Not many of the people that signed their name and said, we're going to be helping you. We'll help you. All right. Now, at that point, I just said, that's it. I'm walking away from it. My brother took it over, and he's been busting his butt for the past 10, 15 years trying to keep it together. And of course, the NRA laid him off because they're going bankrupt. But this is one of the things that I found. When people have a fear that something's going to happen to them, and you look at different categories, it could be firearms, it could be food, it could be water, it could be cars, it could be gas. When they have a fear that something's going to happen to them, at that exact moment, they're all more than willing to jump in and give a good speech about how we all should help each other and protect our rights. But when their faces aren't being rubbed in it, at that moment, they disappear. They go away. And I got tired over the decades of trying to fight to get people to give a crap, which leads me to my story about my grandfather. My grandpa was, he raised me. He was a Cherokee Indian. And he was the sheriff of Placerville during the Depression. And he told me a story. He would tell me parables about certain things. Most of them, I had no clue what the hell he was talking about. Until I got older, and then I went, oh, snap. Now I know what he was talking about. So Placerville, if any of you have been there, downtown area, has wooden sidewalks. And they have since the founding of that city. They're not wooden sidewalks everywhere, but mostly downtown. And during the Depression, 30s, it was all wooden sidewalks. And every morning he'd get up about 4 a.m. and he'd do his walk. He'd walk down the sidewalks to make sure all the doors were locked and there was no drunk laying out in the street or nothing happening. Make sure the sidewalks were cleaned of people or horses. And he comes around this one curve, and right in the middle of that wooden sidewalk is a large, fresh, steaming pile of bear crap. Well, that ain't my job. I'm not cleaning that up. And he walked around it, and he kept on with his walk. Well, that was Saturday morning. The rest of Saturday, all the townspeople that were out walking on that sidewalk were, wow, that is disgusting. Somebody needs to clean that up, and off they'd go. Nobody cleaned it up, and it started getting worse on Sunday. Now you can see the maggots moving in it, and it was really gross, and the kids were coming by and poking at it with sticks and such, but nobody's going to pick it up because it's not their job. Come Monday morning, the mayor's walking to his office. He trips, falls flat on his face in that pile of steaming, rotten bear crap. Well, you bet it got cleaned up right then. But that's the problem with humans. Unless they get their face rubbed in the crap real hard, they don't want to do anything. And I've spent many, many, many decades trying to get people motivated to actually do something. And the bad thing is, once we do get motivated, we have this fascist government that we have had for well over 100 years start sending their informants, confidential informants, CIs they're called, or just plain FBI agents into these organizations. We had an organization here in Coeur d'Alene and had been around for 30, 40 years called Americans for Constitutional Government. We'd have a potluck during the winter, and we'd have a barbecue during the summer. And there'd be a couple, 200-300 of us out there, and senators would come and talk, and congressmen would talk, and other people would talk. And about 2005, I've been working with the FBI to help create the cyber warfare department, which my son and I and a third party, we worked on for a whole year and then turned back over to the FBI. Some people ripped us off, like my company, Survival Enterprises, for about $200,000. And I took umbrage at that. And I went after the son of a bitches. And I got a hold of the FBI, told them what I was doing, and they gave me what you would call 007, meaning I could do anything I wanted on the internet and get away with it. All right. So anyway, so I'd worked with the FBI a little bit. And I realized that we'd been infiltrated. And the people that infiltrated it, the Americans for Constitutional Government, were the rabble-rousers. These were the ones saying, you know, we all ought to start packing guns all the time. Nothing wrong with that, but they're out there saying this to people, right, at the meetings. You know, we ought to pack guns all the time. We ought to have our own courts. We ought to arrest these bastards. If they think they're going to do anything, we had this barbecue. I got up and I talked, and I explained to them exactly what I'm explaining to you. I said every agency, every group, every club, every you get 10 people together, one of them's going to be a CI. One of them's going to infiltrate. One of them's going to get your name and address and phone number, and they're going to make files on you. Every single, including the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and whatever. And then I said, it's simple as this. I know two FBI agents are here right now, and I give them 5 minutes to get up and leave, or I'm going to name them. Four people got up and left. So I only knew two of them. They didn't know me. But this is one of the reasons why I don't go and do any of this stuff. And the other reason is that if I go to a meeting, the agents there are looking for me. They know that I'm there. Maybe some of you know my history. Most of you don't. So I don't want anybody out there being associated with me because it could cause them problems. And in this day and age, if the government, any facet of this government, wants you, you have no rights. They will arrest you, and then it's your job to prove your innocence. And don't say, well, I'm not doing anything illegal. You know how easy it is for me to take your voice and make it sound like you're threatening the president? I can do that just in the same studio I'm recording. It's not hard, and they do it all the time.
You've been trolled, you've been trolled, yes, you've probably been told. Don't reply to this guy, he's just trying to get a rise out of you. Yes, it's true, you respond and that's his cue to start trouble on the double while he strokes his manly stubble. You've been trolled, you've been trolled, you should probably just fold when the only winning move is not to play. And yet you keep on trying, mindlessly replying. You've been trolled, you've been trolled. Have a nice day.
The other thing is, there are what we call trolls. These are people, and most of the time, they work for a government agency or an NGO, non-government organization. And that their job is to infiltrate chat rooms, blogs, and invalidate certain viewpoints or validate certain viewpoints. Like if you're in a chat room and it's all mothers and you start talking about how, you're not going to get your child a vaccination, and then somebody pops up and says, oh, you're a fool. You need to give that kid a vaccination. Well, that's a troll. Now, the government trolls, their intent is to confuse the hell out of you. Confuse the hell out of you. Or piss you off. I was on a Oracle Broadcasting Network. It was a network for radio hosts, and we had a troll in our chat room. And this troll was telling me, he goes, you know, Mike says that you're full of crap. Mike says that you're an idiot, and nobody should ever listen to you. And I'm like, now Mike was another host. I knew this was a lie. I knew this guy was trying to get a reaction out of me, so I ignored him. And then Mike comes in my chat room and says, who the hell do you think you are to tell everybody that I'm a fool and blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, oh, my God, this guy is an idiot. He listened to this troll, and he's reacting exactly the way the troll wants. The purpose of these people is to throw a monkey wrench into the works so everybody gets confused and angry and don't, and then people don't pay attention to what reality is and what's going on. And there's trolls all over the place. They're not just on the internet. They're in groups. They're in organizations. They're in clubs. And their job is to keep your attention sucked into yourself and those around you so that you can't pay attention to life and to what's really going on. Anyway, just, you know, word of warning and a little information. I got an email this week. Now, you guys know we sell nutritional products. We also sell topical pain relief. We've got three different types of things you can rub on pain, and then the pain pretty much goes away, including, it's called Cobrazol. It's a good little roll-on, like an underarm deodorant roll-on, and it has all kinds of neat herbal stuff in it, including three snake venoms. Okay, so we got that. Now, I get an email in the mail. Now, for some reason, I'm listed in some catalog as a pharmaceutical representative. So I have these drug companies all the time send me these emails saying, hey, we got this drug here, and you can make money off of it, and you can rep it for us, and blah, 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 blah. And I ignore most of them. But I got this one email. It really pissed me off. You know I don't like charging people more money than what something is worth. You come into my store, you're going to see stuff in here cheap. You're going, what the? That's cheap. Okay, so this guy sends me this email, and it's called Lido Pro. This is a tube of pain relief. It's a 3-ounce tube, and it's called Lido Pro. It's 4% lidocaine, which is an anesthetic, 10% menthol, capsaicin, and then it has methyl salicylate in it, which is aspirin, but it's 27.5% methyl salicylate, so it's prescription only. Now, that's fine. Until the guy tells me what the price is on this. He goes, look, you can retail this for $1,035 a tube, and insurance companies will pay it. Well, I got really pissed off about that, and I wrote him an email. I said, and I reamed him up one side and down the other. I said, people are getting screwed enough as it is with insurance companies and medical problems, overcharge and this stuff and that. You dare to tell me that you want me to take a tube of this 3-ounce stuff and sell it for $1,000? And I said, you need to go look, and there's some other products out there. And one of them, and I said, a guy sent me last year some samples for something called Neptune Ice. It's the same stuff. It's got 4% lidocaine, it's got camphor, it's got menthol, it's got dimethicone, which is another anesthetic. And it's organic. It has aloe in it, and boswellia serrat, and arnica flower. I said, you need to look at that. And he emails him back, he goes, oh, we sell that stuff too. So I'm a representative of that stuff now. It's called Neptune Ice. This, no ifs, ands, or buts, is going to kill your pain. It has a unique smell to it because of the menthol and the camphor in it. But this is called Neptune Ice. I don't even have it on a website yet at all. It's nowhere because I just got him in. It's blue, and yeah, you're going to smell like grandpa for a while, but the smell goes away. You can either go and put it on your fingers and rub it into an area, or the tip of it is kind of a soft foam. And it's an applicator tip is what it's called. So you can squeeze some of it out, and then you can rub it on with this. All right. So this stuff, no ifs, ands, or buts, is going to kill the pain. And we have a guy who just had his knee replaced, and he was in intense pain. And he didn't want to use CBD, didn't want to use any of the other stuff. I gave him a little sample of this, and he came back the next day and bought 4 tubes. And I told him, I said, look, you can use as much as you want, but don't waste this stuff. He goes, oh, no, these other 3 tubes are going in the refrigerator. I'm using this one. So just so you guys know, we got a new product. It's called Neptune Ice. And it'll be on the page. Or you can call us, 800-753-1981. They're only $15 a tube. It's not a big deal. It's not no $1,000 a tube like they want for the stuff with the aspirin in it. That just grinds my cookies. I don't know. Anyway, all right, let's get on with the show. So we're going to get into the economy. You know, these airlines that were complaining because, well, they're just not getting the money that they need because of the COVID and all this crap. So they were bailed out. Now they're charging for COVID recovery. So you go buy an airline ticket, you're going to look, and you're going to find this in the fine print, COVID recovery fee. Start watching for this now. Not just in the airlines, in everything. Everything you buy, every restaurant you go into, everybody you pay, watch for this bogus COVID recovery fee and refuse to pay it. We're all in the same boat together, and I'm sure as hell not going to pay somebody because he was stupid enough to close. So watch out for the COVID recovery fee. Now, they might change the words on it or something. Have you ever heard of near-field communication? You know, you got a credit card with this little RFID in it, and when you go to pay, you just kind of bring it close to the credit card machine, and it reads it. That's called NFC, near. Well, this guy, he's a researcher. He discovered that there's a flaw in that system, and he can literally take his cell phone, go to, it's an Android app you can get, and you go to an ATM and you just wave your phone in front of it, and all of a sudden, boom, you can do all kinds of stuff to the ATM. Now, you can't. I'm not going to tell you how you do it, but there's an article there that I'll post on my show notes. And I hear, if you want to know what it is, you look at your credit card, and if you have an RFID, radio frequency identification device, near field communication system in there, meaning you don't have to be, you don't have to slip it in to a credit card machine, you will see a little half a line, kind of a curved line, and then another one smaller, and then another one smaller, like three or four lines curved like that. That signals that is a RFID signaler. And we have these Mylar pouches. The credit card slips right in them. I don't remember. It's like $7 for five of them, but your credit card is 100% protected. So I have these on any of my credit cards that I'm using that have RFIDs in it. Okay, now we're going into the health department. For those of you in Massachusetts, like Jeff, over 4,000 Massachusetts residents who have been fully vaccinated have tested positive for COVID. Considering there is no COVID virus that has been segregated or even discovered yet, I don't know how they can figure out that they tested positive for COVID, but 4,000 of them that have been vaxxed tested positive. Now, speaking of 4,000 women so far. Now, this is just who's reported. This is the problem. Not everybody reports when they have a problem. Over 4,000 women, though, report menstrual problems, heavy bleeding, nonstop bleeding, delayed periods, and this is from getting vaxxed. Stupid is as stupid does, but these females that go get vaxxed, and especially if they're childbearing ages, do you know how many women miscarried? Is a 3,000% increase in miscarriages worldwide to women who have had a vaccination. If you're pregnant, you don't need to show how stupid you are. Don't get vaccinated. It's as stupid as vaccinating your babies. And speaking of stupid, children from the age of 12 to 17, their injuries have surpassed 7,000. This blows my mind. Four babies die because of a Fisher-Price toy, and they recall all of them. Actually, it shows it's the reported injuries. It was 7,000 a few days ago. It's now 11,000 in ages 12 to 17. These are our children. Reports of anaphylaxis, heart inflammation, blood clotting disorders. We have had thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the United States alone die from this vaccination. If not within the hour, then a few weeks later. You notice how airline flights started to be canceled like crazy. And they're not saying why. There was an article, in fact, there's so many flights are being canceled that there was an article on CNN I was looking at yesterday, and they said, well, look, all these flights are canceled or delayed. And they can't, and nobody's telling us why. I can tell you why. Because pilots are dying from getting vaccinated or becoming so ill that they can't fly. This is real. And they're hiding all of this from you. They're not going to tell you. Like, I'm in Coeur d'Alene. Do you think the Coeur d'Alene press is going to come out and say 38 people died from getting the vaccination today? You think they're going to come out and say that? No, they're not. The next thing you got now is this so-called Delta variant. It's going to surge amongst the unvaccinated. Well, I read an article, a medical paper that was saying the symptoms of this Delta variant are like hay fever. We wonder if these people don't just have hay fever. So what's going to happen? I want you to hear a little bit of a series on Amazon that came out in 2020.
We created a flu that sparked the demand for a vaccine that doesn't work. After everyone in the country is vaccinated.
And the world.
He'll have murdered millions.
Nope, you don't have it. We need to go. Now, before that vaccine ships and more people die.
Give a certain percentage of the population a fatal illness, and you make sure it's genetic. See, that was the exciting part. You pass it down. So if you have children before you die... Becky, do you have children? How much evil do you have to do good? People are driven by the need to know what happens next. Do you want to know what happens next? Your father created a world-changing, not world-ending, a world-changing, world-improving omnivirus. And we have taken that virus and embedded it in the vaccine of the Stearns flu.
I knew it.
I knew it.
You created a panic, and now everybody's begging for the vaccine.
No. Demanding it. With all the entitlement of a first world country.
Yes. And now we have exactly what we want. Hundreds of millions of Americans lining up, offering us their arms, and letting us give them our creation.
I'm pretty sure when every vaccinated person starts dying, they'll trace it back to undetectable virus or not.
You've all been very busy. You're all very sharp. Are you sure none of you would like to come and work for me? No? Better than dying a terrible, violent death? Then understand this. What we are doing is far bigger than death.
This virus is not deadly.
Exactly. Everything I do is a cure for our current situation.
And how's it a cure if
you're killing people?
I told you it does not kill. That was the amazing epiphany we had. We didn't have to kill to accomplish our goal. We intend to stop human reproduction for three generations. The busy, endless global assembly line of babies will grind to a halt.
Sterilizing people?
Uh-huh. In the first 5 years, we'll start to see major birth rate declines as teenagers vaccinated today hit their childbearing years.
You're controlling the future of human civilization.
Is that what they're calling it? It's a very nice euphemism for a species that has replicated like a contagion across the planet, killing all other species in its wake, except things that are cute, like puppies or koalas.
Pandas.
You hate people that much?
On the contrary, I love people.
Then how?
Why would doing what our government or citizenry is too spoiled or self-indulgent to do? We are saving ourselves from ourselves.
Halting overpopulation.
100 years ago, the global population was 1.7 billion. 2011, it reached...
7 billion.
2050, they say it's going to plateau.
Mm-mm-mm. We'll blow past 11 billion and then slowly begin to decline.
But by then, it'll be too late to save an Earth that bears any resemblance to a world we actually want to live in. This planet. So I decided to take care of the problem.
By injecting your virus into the veins of every human on it?
Global warming, mass extinctions, food, water shortages. All these problems can be boiled down to one thing. Overpopulation.
It's not as simple as that.
But it is. At 1.7 billion, we can be as decadent, self-indulgent we want. At 10 billion, we have to live strategically. We have to live modestly. We have to live selflessly. And as you know, we're not that good at it.
And you're beta testing it on Americans since we're the worst.
If we don't do something now, right now, in a decade, our world will experience extraordinary privations. A war of all against all.
Water. We'll go to war over water, and the people who will die first are the ones without power and money.
And by then, we'll be fighting over a world that really isn't worth fighting for.
You can't just decide people won't have babies because...
I can and I did.
What about what this does to people, society?
Salvation. We can form a new society. The grand social experiment.
Now, I want to read you the premise of this series. And this is, obviously, this is supposed to be hypothetical, correct? But I can tell you this. The elites of the world never hide what they're going to do to us. They never hide what they're doing to us either. They always tell us. They always warn us, this is what they're going to do. And then they tell us, this is what we're doing. And then they have their CIA-controlled mainstream media, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, tell us that we don't know what we're thinking of because it's not happening like we think it is, and it's all a lie. They're here to help us. So the premise of this... A group of comic book fans discover an unpublished manuscript for a graphic novel and come to believe that the manuscript foretells future events. Dark forces are also searching for the manuscript. The comic book fans discover a global conspiracy. The comic book contains clues of future events because it's written by one of the architects of the plan designed to prevent ecological disaster as the Earth's population rises and resources are depleted. The plan consists of, number one, convincing the world's population that there's an outbreak of a deadly new virus. Number two, once convinced of the narrative of the phony pandemic, announce to the public the creation of a new vaccine. Number three, through the coordination between global elites and non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, governments move quickly to inject the world's population with this so-called vaccine. And number four, once the population is injected, it turns out that the vaccine is designed to sterilize almost all of those people that take it, causing the global population to drop from 7.8 billion to about 500 million. Here's the key part that I want you to understand. This whole series, Utopia, is taken from a 2013 British series under the same name. They told us 8 years ago what they were going to do. One of the things that I tell people is that there's a lot of information out here. There's a lot of information that most people will not pay attention to, and then they're going to be surprised when something happens that they should have already known about. I got a clip from the Ice Age Farmer. This is some of that information.
Ladies and gentlemen, the biggest meat company in the world, JBS, is currently shut down globally because of a cyber attack. Now, if you remember the Americold cyber attack, where the cold storage provider had their systems go down and everything just ground to a halt. They didn't know what was coming in on these trucks. They didn't know what was supposed to be going out on the other trucks. They didn't know what was in their huge cold storage freezer, this pallet over there, where everything just stopped until they were able to get those systems back up. This same scenario is now transpiring at JBS, except that there are animals involved. They don't know where their cows are. They don't know where their animal feed is. They don't know where their truckers are supposed to be going to pick these things up or to bring them over for processing. Again, when live animals are involved, and as in general with our supply chain, everything is so fine-tuned, it's just a just-in-time supply chain, that there are dangerous situations that happen here. So for example, many of these feedlots have just enough feed to feed the animals until the very day that they go off for processing. But now that the whole engine has shut down, those animals are still there and there's no food for them. So you can see how this can, even within a couple of days, very quickly cascades into a humanitarian crisis for the animals and certainly into outsized disruptions of the global protein supply and the meat market. In fact, you can see union reps are already saying there could be a protein deficiency globally if we're not able to get JBS back online and processing. Now, what's not mentioned is that JBS had already been stopping some of their facilities. In fact, we've talked about this. The drought in Brazil was destroying their safrinha, their corn crop there, and feed costs were exploding. Now that we've got $7 corn, we got these meat companies that are basically just feeding money into the cows, and then they're not even able to sell their meat anymore because people can't afford to pay that kind of price. The demand, it says domestic demand is dwindling. Demand is still there. It's just that they're priced out of the market. People can't afford super expensive meat, so now they're starting to idle their operations. This is April 12th. Brazilian beef packers are halting production in selected locations. Well, that's not a very good story, right? Are we just going to stop making meat because we run out of animal feed? That doesn't really sound good, but what sounds better is if we just marry these two things. What better time than just to marry the World Economic Forum's cyber pandemic and these cyber attacks on our critical infrastructure with the war on meat? So all of a sudden, this perfectly scripted cyber attack on JBS happens. Again, it wasn't just JBS and beef. You can see Reuters reporting that BRF, the world's largest poultry exporter, that's where the rest of the world gets their chicken, is from the biggest exporter of poultry in the world, that was considering slaughtering their chickens and stopping their pork and poultry plants. Why? Because of the record corn prices. Because we can't get animal feed, or we can't afford to feed these animals. JBS was doing the same thing. And so it is no surprise that they reach into their back pocket and pull out that perfect excuse, the cyber pandemic. They are, after all, a World Economic Forum partner company. Here from wefforum.org, JBS, the world's largest processors of animal protein. Well, that's pretty insightful, isn't it? That they're a partner with the World Economic Forum, who's openly advocating for the post-animal economy. Yeah, it's because JBS is in on it. They want to end animal agriculture. So does Tyson. Here's Tyson. Tyson Foods, stating their commitment to sustainable protein, and to Davos, to the World Economic Forum. Yeah, they're in on this. So when we heard Klaus Schwab utter those words last year at the Cyber Polygon think tank exercise where they talked about how there's going to be a cyber pandemic, he said,
"We all know, but still pay insufficient attention to the frightening scenario of a comprehensive cyber attack, which would bring to a complete halt to the power supply, transportation, hospital services, our society as a whole. The COVID-19 crisis would be seen in this respect as a small disturbance in comparison to a major cyber attack."
And as Klaus Schwab uttered those words, and as the FireEye hacking toolkit was stolen, and as the SolarWinds hack meant that Fortune 500 companies and governments around the world were suddenly vulnerable to any of these things, suddenly that script was launched. This carte blanche for anyone to do anything they wanted to their pipelines or to their meatpacking facilities. Just shut it down. Turn it off for a while. Let the gas prices rise. Let the meat prices rise. They're just starving out consumers and getting them used to this new normal. Increased gas prices, increased meat prices. Let's look a little bit about what JBS is saying. There will be, quote, severe economic impact on workers at the offline production facilities. Quote, it depends how long this goes on for and how long JBS stays offline. It's a supply chain that starts right at the farm gate, right through to the feedlots, all the way down to truck drivers. Everyone is severely impacted by a complete stoppage of the meat industry. And of course, this isn't the first blow to meat production. Argentina had already stopped exporting all of their grains and then even their beef to Brazil to try and keep domestic prices controlled. It was this, in fact, that prompted Brazilian meatpackers to say, if I can't get access to those grains from Argentina, then I can't afford to feed my animals. And that's where we started seeing those headlines initially about, we're going to start slowing down the meat production. Now they've just hit the panic button and launched into overdrive, blamed the cyber pandemic. And it's just like blaming COVID. It's just this boogeyman. Global problems require global solutions. Plus, it buys us the ability to turn off the meat. We can just do whatever we want. Now, at the same time, we've got these fake meat companies also working hand in hand with the World Economic Forum. And in fact, they're going out and donating fake meat right now to food banks and food pantries and to other emergency sources. So when people who are losing their jobs in these lockdowns are going out to get help from the food banks, they don't come home with real meat anymore. They come home with trash from the Meatless Farm Company and Impossible Burgers and stuff like that. Now, who are these companies that are just giving away fake meat, right? That doesn't seem like a very good business model, to invent a new product and then just give it away, 20,000 vegan sausages. Well, if you look at this company, just as one example, this Meatless Farm Company, well, they raised a new round, $31 million to fund post-lockdown growth. The gentleman who ran that round. The funding round was managed by recently appointed Meatless Farm Director, Leopoldo Zambelletti, who has 20 years of investment banking experience at JP Morgan and Credit Suisse. Leopoldo said, this funding gives Meatless Farms the ability to take advantage of consumers' desire to build back better in the wake of COVID-19. He's right there, virtue signaling. This is part of the Great Reset. This is part of weaning people off of meat now that they're just going to shut down the production and blame the cyber pandemic, and we'll give away our free meat over here. They're going to get this done by hook or by crook. You remember Wired Magazine, fake meat is coming whether or not you like it. Now you see what they mean. At the same time, there are other supply chain disruptions that we could talk about. And again, this is some of the speculation I've heard from within JBS, was that they weren't able to get their trucks to deliver enough animal feed to keep their operations running, that they had to hit this panic button and shut down operations because the feed was too expensive or it wasn't there at all. And here's one hint that that might be the case from DairyHerd.com. Where are all the truckers? Quote, there's currently a nationwide deficit of both long-haul and short-run truck drivers. It is impacting the transit of feed, fuel, milk, and dairy products. It's already impacted these things. And this is just going to get worse. It's impacting the whole supply chain, getting the trucks where they need to go, getting in and out of warehouses because of workforce and equipment issues. It's causing problems. And so if dairy farmers are having problems getting their feed, then obviously JBS, Smithfield, Tyson, all these other meat producers are going to be encountering similar logistical difficulties. And again, the big story here is that we're running out of grains, right? We lost that third crop of corn, the safrinha crop in Brazil. We are actively losing yield here in the United States right now, you can see from this latest drought monitor graph from the USDA that the severe areas of drought are overlapping about 24% of U.S. corn production. So that huge corn crop that the U.S. needed this year, required this year, to make up for last year and for the loss in Brazil, it's not going to be there either. This global grains shortage is not going away. The $7 corn, get used to it. And that's why they're shutting off the meat. There's a whole bunch of other stories that we could talk about right now, but it's the early hours of this, and I really think we should just stay tuned. Let's watch how long they keep JBS turned off, and that's going to be very insightful. Was this a lasting blow because they don't have any grains to feed animals? Is this just the cover story for the end of animal agriculture? But just initially, as this breaks, it's worth noting this is a perfect marriage of the cyber pandemic narrative, of the war on meat, and all of these scripts coming together, plus massive economic damage and further difficulties to the supply chain being introduced. We had said that there would be cyber attacks on our supply chain and on our food system, and here they are. Welcome to it.
One of the reasons people listen to alternative radio, like me, because of the saying, forewarned is forearmed. You get a little bit of information. You never know when you're going to get information. What the saying is about clocks. A broken clock is still right twice a day. Same thing with humans. You don't know. Out of my mouth might come some information that could save your life or help you in the future. Who knows? So pay attention to everything around you. The big thing, the big company that's popping up right now is called Impossible Foods. Impossible Foods, I followed them since the beginning. And I was thinking about investing in them, and eventually I did put some money in them. But they claim that they're the new healthy way to eat, and they make, the key I liked was they made hamburgers that weren't made out of burgers, right? I thought that was kind of cool. I don't mind. I've eaten mushroom burgers and bean burgers and all this other stuff. Well, unfortunately about this Impossible Foods, and this is with all of these synthetic foods, these synthetic meats, and they claim that they're saving the earth and this is a solution to meats and all of this crap, except for one minor thing. The majority of the ingredients in most of these synthetic foods is soy. Unfortunately, all soy in the United States, soybeans, is genetically modified. Now, why does that matter? Well, let me explain. I'll try and do this as succinct as possible. Monsanto invented this weed killer. It's an herbicide is what it is. It kills everything. And then they created, now this was a long time. This was like a 10-year period. People got that stuff and said, wow, that's great. I can kill all the weeds in this area. Just spray this on and it kills everything. Then they invented corn seeds that were impervious to glyphosate, or Roundup as it's called. In other words, no longer did a farmer have to plant rows of corn so that he could walk through and hoe and pull out the weeds and stuff like that. No longer did he have to do that. He could just plant them so close together, it's ridiculous. And then he'd just have a plane fly over the whole crop and spray glyphosate, knowing the corn's not going to be affected, but everything else is going to die off. Everything. Well, they do the same thing with soy. Now, this glyphosate kills all flora. What do you have in your stomach? To help your digestion, you have flora. So these plants, whether it's corn or soy, absorb the glyphosate, the Roundup. It doesn't kill the plant. It just absorbs it. And then when the plant's harvested and then processed and then made into corn tortillas or corn flakes or soy burgers or what have you, that glyphosate goes directly into your system. And then you end up, and a lot of people end up, having all kinds of reactions, from stomach problems to cramps to wondering why they have diarrhea chronically. So these are genetically engineered crops, and they're being touted as the cure-all for the beef industry, to get rid of it. You no longer need to eat beef or pork or chicken or even fish, because now you've got some synthetic that you can put into a mush and press out and make fish sticks out of. Unfortunately, they're loaded with glyphosate. So that is just something that I had to throw in there. And you've probably heard about this part. Now, you know, we're going into a drought in the western United States. Without going into a long dissertation on this, California is basically dumping all rain and all melt, snow melt, directly into the ocean. And they pretty much have been for a long time. That's part of their job, is to control how much water is in reservoirs. They don't want a reservoir full and then have a lot of rain and then the reservoir will flood. So what they do is they're supposed to monitor and say, hey, we're going to have rain for a week, so why don't we drop about 20% of the height of the reservoir down, and then we'll be safe. They're doing this on purpose. They're draining reservoirs. My grandfather in the 30s and 40s helped build reservoirs, Ice House, Loon Lake, up in Northern California. So there was reasons for him. And whoever's in charge of California for the past 25 years, easy, either doesn't give a damn or wants to stop all farming. And that is more of what I think is happening. There's another little clip here from the Ice Age farmer talking about how they want to have a zero carbon future. You know, it might take up time in my show, but all of these things have information in that people need to know.
Researchers from the Australian National University are calling for climate change to be added to death certificates. The experts from ANU's medical school says while official records over the past 11 years show 340 deaths in Australia were due to excessive heat, their new analysis found more than 36,000 deaths over that period could have been attributed to heat. If true, those figures would put Australia's heat-related mortality rate at about 2%. The ANU academics are pushing for death certification to be modernised to reflect the impact of climate change as a secondary cause of death in instances of heat exposure or asthma attacks due to bushfire smoke.
Yes, climate change as the cause of death, because what better way to justify, what better propaganda to usher in complete control than to say, look at the millions of people that have died. And of course, we already see the scripting here as well with people like Bill Gates saying, hey, climate change is going to kill more people than coronavirus. With Time magazine saying climate change is going to kill more people than infectious diseases. CNN out there saying, oh, that's probably 250,000 people a year from climate change conservatively, right? They've already started messaging that climate change is killing people. And so now they want to add this as cause of death so that they can just count up as many as they want. What's the goal? Is to justify things like this.
Matthew's paper really was about what we might want to do to make ourselves, how we might ethically edit ourselves for climate change, for example. But so I'm really curious to hear where you take all of this.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm probably more on the more permissive side of this whole spectrum. I think that I agree with everybody here that in the near term, the research should go forward. I don't see much of a big problem with sort of synthesizing yeast, you know, genomes and sort of, or studying sort of aspects of the human genome. My view is that what we need is a really robust ethical framework. Within this ethical, robust ethical framework, I think there's a way going forward where we can do this ethically. But there's actually a lot of opportunities for this to solve big world problems. So one thing is the climate change. And there, I'll just use, you know, sort of climate change is a really big problem. We don't really know how to solve it. But it turns out that we can use human engineering to help us address climate change. So I'll give two examples. So one is that people eat too much meat. And if they were to cut down on their consumption on meat, then it would actually really help the planet. But people are not willing to give up meat. Yeah, you know, some people will be willing to, but other people, they may be willing to, but they have a weakness of will. They say, wow, this steak is just too juicy. I can't do it. I'm one of those, by the way. So, you know, but so here's the thought, right? So it turns out that we know a lot about, so there we have these intolerance to, so I, for example, I have milk intolerance. And there's some people are intolerant to crayfish. So possibly we can use human engineering to make it the case that we're intolerant to certain kinds of meat, to certain kinds of bovine proteins. And there's actually analogs of this in life. There's this thing called the Lone Star tick, where if it bites you, you will become allergic to meat. I can sort of describe the mechanism. So that's something that we can do through human engineering. We can kind of possibly address really big world problems through human engineering. Another example is, and
you go first.
Yeah. And another example is sort of, and here I'll go first, right? You'll see that I'm the smallest person here. Right? And well, yeah, Amy's the smallest person. So it turns out that the larger you are, think of the lifetime sort of greenhouse gas emissions that are required to sort of the energy that's required to transport larger people rather than smaller people, right? But if we're smaller just by 15 centimeters, right, that's a mass, you know, I did the math, and it's about mass reduction of 25%, which is huge. And 100 years ago, we're all on the average smaller, about 15 centimeters smaller, right? So think of just the, you know, like lifetime greenhouse gas emissions if we had smaller children. Right. And so that's something that we could do through some human.
Could we, like, setting aside, should we?
Yes. Setting aside, should we? Don't need to ask that question. He's just a bioethicist, after all. Matthew Lau, as he calls himself. This is the only reason he gives lip service to a robust ethical framework, as he suggests that we should genetically engineer people against their will to be meat intolerant, or give people cat-like eyes that reduce the need for lighting at night because of our carbon footprint. Or we can genetically engineer our children to be the size of cats because over the lifetime they'll have less greenhouse gas emissions. These are his suggestions. And ladies and gentlemen, yes, they sound crazy, don't they? They sound equally ludicrous as vaccine passports sounded 18 months ago. But given the right crisis and given the appropriate amount of fear pushed out through the propaganda outlets, you can see how people would line up for these things just as they are, virtue signaling as they get their kill shots right now. And it's not just Matthew Lau who's out there saying these crazy things. No, he is walking hand in hand with Klaus Schwab and the people at the World Economic Forum. How bioengineering will change our world in the next 10 years. This is what it means when he talks about biohacking and cybernetics as part of the Great Reset, as part of this fourth industrial revolution, engineering a post-human world, where, as you can read right here, citizens vaccinated by consuming edible vaccines and plants. Well, no wonder they need control over the food supply. No wonder it's going to be illegal for you to have a garden, because, ladies and gentlemen, this is their plan, and there's no one coming to save you, I'm sorry to tell you. It's going to be up to you to get the word out and for all of us to fight this right now. And why am I talking about this? Why is Christian going off about humans the size of cats? What does this have to do with food? Because if I just say that they're shutting off the world food supply, then I sound crazy. But it's not until we have a cup of tea and acknowledge their own words, their own plans are so crazy, are so satanic. This transhumanist future that they have envisioned is being created by virtue of this huge crisis, this worldwide famine, climate change. They'll blame for it. And I'm not the only one saying this at this point. In fact, just last week, a Dutch member of parliament stood up and saying, we're going to have food shortages if we keep replacing our fertile agricultural lands with these wind farms. This is insanity, and it must stop. I'm not holding back anymore, ladies and gentlemen. I never did, but at this point, we've got to be all in. And so that's why I wanted to really do the deep dive into the motivations behind why they're just turning off the food. And now let's talk more about how they're doing that.
The drastic limits placed on what little water they have.
We've all made serious choices of what fields we can water and what we can't.
Tom Favero says he and many farmers along this west side of Weber County are having to watch some crops die. People like Dean Martini.
That corn there where I can't water it, don't have the water, makes me sick to see it go to heck like that.
With limits on amount and time, he says there isn't enough flow to make it across his fields. While some of the corn is drying up, he's had to let this whole field of barley go.
That hurts, buddy. That hurts.
All after he's put the work in.
Plowing, foot fertilizer and everything on, and then see this. That makes a guy sick.
It all means less feed for his dairy. He'll have to try and buy from other farmers who also have shortened supply, driving prices up.
If we ain't gonna have it, then yeah, cows are gonna have to go too.
Favero, who only grows feed, says he won't have enough to go around.
We're going
to
be back in production at least 30% of what normal should be. And hopefully we're only at a lack of 30%. It might be closer to 50%.
And the key phrase in there was, the animals will have to go too. The cows will go. You can see this isn't just bad for crop production. This is, in fact, an attack on ranching as well. And moving on to California, and I hope you saw the first piece I did on the drought water wars, where we could pretty clearly clearly demonstrate that we had more than 5 years worth of water 18 months ago, and somehow it's just gone. This is clearly an engineered drought, a manufactured situation we find ourselves in. It continues to get worse and worse until just a few days ago, the federal government actually said, we're going to cut those allocations to zero. You're now going to get no water. And some of the reactions from farmers are pretty desperate.
Paddocks once packed with tomatoes to cotton in Salvador Parra's farm now look like a barren wasteland. As California suffers its worst drought since 1977, everyone, from farmers like Parra down to the average consumer, will soon be feeling the heat. A third of Parra's 6,000-acre Burford Ranch now lies fallow, and he's had to dig deep for water for the remaining crops.
Because of this drought, we're having to pipe water from another well. It's 4 miles, taking us 4 miles worth of pipeline to get this water here.
Parra fears that consumers will soon pay the price.
So consumers should be worried about garlic and onions and other crops because come this time next year, they're going to be very scarce and the cost is going to be higher. Most of the garlic in the United States is grown here in California. And so not having the water, growers will not be able to grow it.
California is one of the country's top producers of vegetables, berries, and all sorts of crops.
The warning from the state to thousands of farmers that their water could be shut off is more than just a cautionary notice for the agricultural community.
Well, essentially, if you don't have a well, you're really facing some hard times.
Farmers say this could lead to catastrophe.
We've already seen about 15% of our workforce severely impacted by this drought.
The State Water Resources Board notified 6,600 farmers Tuesday that they could face water cutoffs as the state deals with the ongoing drought, dry conditions that have already cut off federal and state irrigation supplies.
We are seeing unprecedented amounts of fallowing. We've already lost several corn crops across the state.
Anil Radabaugh says a number of farmers have fallowed land, meaning acres will not be used, left untouched.
If you have orchards or vineyards and you're told to cut back your water, cut off your water, you're essentially killing that orchard or that vineyard.
Bruce Blodgett says what could happen is that smaller operations may have no choice but to shut down, which could lead to layoffs and a loss of revenue for county governments.
For those that have permanent crops, this could be devastating.
The state says the cutoff may continue until winter rains come. In the meantime, farmers do their best to mitigate potential devastation by recycling water.
And before I move on, let me just amplify a couple of the things we just heard. One, that we're also seeing hay shortages, which means farmers and ranchers are competing for the ability to feed their animals. And secondly, that we're not just cutting off water to annual crops, but also to orchards and vineyards. These are things that take tremendous amounts of capital investment, and in some cases, like almonds and walnuts, a decade to establish before they even produce. So this is a lasting reduction in our agricultural output. And the story, again, is the same across California into Oregon, where it's also being conflated with the white nationalist, white supremacist, militia, Ammon Bundy nonsense, even as the mainstream media prints stories about QAnon supporters are going to get violent now because they can no longer trust the plan. So we should all be very concerned about the scripting around this false flag looming as they cut off the water to farmers and make people very desperate, because this is the pretense for the weaponization, the turning of the entire police state apparatus, and indeed even the military against Americans. This is very concerning. I told you there was a tremendous amount of information to cover today. And if I were just doing this for clicks, if I were just some professional YouTuber and that was my shtick, then I would cut this all into a little tiny bite-sized things. Oh, humans the size of cats, isn't that crazy? That's not my goal. Okay, I'm not trying to waste your time or my time. I want to have a big picture conversation about what they're doing. They're moving to a post-human world and how they're doing it through the engineering of a global famine that we're now on the brink of.
Now, you know, I mentioned earlier about this synthetic glop that they're turning into meats and stuff. It reminded me there was a lawsuit filed against Subway because their tuna sandwich, their tuna turned out there's no tuna in it. So California, U.S. District Court of the Northern District of California is suing the chain for fraud because they found that there is no tuna in it. So you guys that go out and buy sandwiches, footlongs or what have you, and it says meat, make sure it is meat. And if it's tuna, well, Subway doesn't use tuna. It uses, they are not sure what it is. I can tell you this, and you're going to like this part. What is the test that they use to determine whether or not you have COVID? It's called a PCR test. In truth, a PCR test does not tell the level of a virus. It just says if the virus is there or not. In reality, I would say 75% of the people in the United States had COVID, and about 74.9% of them never showed any symptoms. And I say this because the PCR test was used to check to see if Subway's tuna had any tuna in it. No, it didn't. All right, now we're going to get into the liberal psychosis. Do you remember, I think it was last summer, when a truck driver was going slow through a Minneapolis highway because he out of the blue, there was all this whole crowd, and they started to attack the truck, and he just took off. Well, they wanted to charge him with attempted murder and all kinds of other crap, and it just to let you know, all the charges were dropped. He's just a working guy, and they freaked out. He freaked out because they started jumping on his truck. Anyway, all the charges were dropped. Just want to let everybody know. Now we're going to go into the Democrat perversion. And it's only the Democrat perversion because only the Democrats are so perverted as this. Nellis Air Force Base is hosting its first ever drag queen show. Now this is great. This is our military. And these guys are supposed to be trained in how to kill people and break things. So now they're promoting some kind of sexual perversion. The Illinois governor, he's another communist, signed a bill that made all government employees gender neutral. In other words, you can't be a man or a woman. Gender neutral. Hey, have you watched all these commercials? Now, this is Pervert Pride Month. So to, to honor the perverts out there, all the drug companies that deal with perverts are having ads all over TV. You know, if you're a pervert and you like doing what perverts do, keep doing it, but just take this drug. And it'll keep you alive longer. I didn't catch what the drug was, this one that I'm watching. I just heard it and I started laughing so hard I couldn't believe it. It's just some drug, and it shows two women stroking each other's hair and then two men kissing. And then they have the fine print, you know, where they talk real quick and give you the warnings. And it says if you were assigned your birth gender was assigned female, then don't take this drug. It could be toxic. If your birth gender was assigned female. Assigned female. Mm-hmm. Okay. Speaking of pervert pride, Kellogg, very proud that they're perverted. Now they want to make sure Tony the Tiger and Toucan Sam are also perverted. So they're pushing Tony the Tiger and Toucan Sam lead Kellogg's Gray Pride Parade. They're pushing this idea. This is for children. This is where you desensitize children against this kind of psychosis. So the U.S. Olympic team has a bunch of cyclists on it. One of them is this transvestite. He calls himself Chelsea Wolf. And if he wins, he says that he's going to burn the U.S. flag on the podium. You know, it's disgusting they use the word she when you're talking about a transvestite. So this is the disgusting, this is the massively evil and disgusting trick that these transvestites are doing, is they're pretending they're males, then they're going to pretend that they're females, and the woke Olympic judges are going to say, okay, if you're calling yourself a female, then you can go ahead and compete as a female, even though you're a male. So here's this cyclist, a transvestite, that says if it wins, it's going to burn the American flag on the podium. New Zealand has this butt-ugly male, morbidly obese, who can barely lift weights, but compared to females, he lifts way more than any of the females do. So New Zealand is allowing that creature to participate in the Olympics. Personally, I would not participate. If I was a woman and I was going to have to participate or compete against that creature, I would quit right then and there. I'd say, no, I'm sorry. This is insane. This is New Zealand. This is going to destroy all sports, female sports. Then there's another one, CeCe Telfer. Telfer. This is a male who still has a penis and he pretends he's female and can outrun and out-hurdle any other female. U.S. Olympic judges just ruled him ineligible. And why? Because there's a touch too much testosterone in its system. Do you realize how stupid our country is looking to the world? And here's the topper. Here's the cherry on top. The U.S. has decided to fly the gay pride flag on all its embassies, especially in Moscow. The U.K., the Canadian, and the U.S. are flying the pervert flag on all of our embassies. I am astounded that we even have a country left. And it didn't take long, did it? As soon as you get Dimwit in charge of the Shady Acres, the whole place just went to hell that quick. Now we're going into the government threat. For those of you who didn't know, John McAfee Epsteined himself this week. Now, McAfee is the guy that invented a antivirus program that was world famous, used in all kinds of different operating systems. Is a pain in the ass to try and delete if you ever get it put on your computer. Now, McAfee was, let's just say, eccentric. He did a lot of oddball things in his 75 years. The government, our U.S. government, hated him because he's like Snowden. He came out with information that upset our government. He would tell people the truth. As a matter of fact, here's a little blurb he came out, and it strangely enough, it sounds exactly like me talking to you about the deep state.
The deep state is a conspiracy theory. It's defined as the people within the U.S. government and military who are in secret control of government policy. Secret? Please, people. The deep state is those people within the U.S. government that are career employees that cannot be fired by people that we elect by the Congress or the President. There are the FCC, the CIA, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the IRS. Are these people in control? Can they enact laws? Yes. They're called regulations. For every law that Congress passes, and we elect Congress to pass our laws, there are 20 regulations enacted by federal agencies that have far more impact on our lives than anything Congress can possibly pass. Is there a deep state? Yes. Can we fire these people? No. Can presidents fire them? No. It's designed that way so that political parties and political interests cannot affect the deep state. Do you understand the nightmare of our situation, people? I'm sorry. It's not secret. It's as open as anything could be. Since 1975, 200,000 regulations have been passed by our federal agencies, encompassing 800,000 pages of fine print. People, it is no secret. It is as open as it can be. The deep state does control America. Wake up, people, please. God, use some common sense.
He said repeatedly that if he ever got captured or arrested by the U.S. government, they would have him commit suicide. And he said, I am not suicidal. I will never commit suicide. He even had a word tattooed on his shoulder. It said, whacked. And he said, if you ever find me dead, read my shoulder. It's very weird what's going on with him. Within an hour of his death, his Twitter account posted a few things. Now, I'm not going to get into it right now because right now it's on the dark web and this is what we're finding out. He had a dead man switch. His wife knew it. He mentioned it before. And he said, if I get whacked, this dead man switch is going to go live. He didn't say when. But there are rumors and there are a lot of research being done on the dark web right now, discovering a lot of data that's getting ready to open up. I can't say anything else about it right now because I don't have enough information to actually tell it to you. All right, so let's see. Now, we're still under government threat. You'll love this one. Washington, D.C. A gentleman, I'm flabbergasted on this one, so it's hard to understand this. This jailed murderer, this guy's in jail for life. He won public office in District of Columbia election. And there were five other inmates running, by the way. So he's on D.C.'s Advisory Neighborhood Commission, which advises the D.C. Council and other local government entities involving matters ranging from liquor license applications to public safety. Commissioners serve two-year terms. So here is this semi-humanoid creature, committed murder, and he got elected to a Washington, D.C. position. And in an unrelated story, the House of Representatives, which is ruled by the Communist Party, approved a bill to create Washington, D.C. as our 51st state. And you can tell these were all Democrats because that's what exists in Washington, D.C. Now, we do have some good news. Nebraska is sending 24 troopers to Texas to help guard the wall. The Texas governor told Dimwit in Washington, D.C., that if you're not going to do the job, we're going to do it. So Texas is going to ask all the other states to please help by sending some law enforcement to help us guard the wall. And by the way, the Texas governor canceled the communist's paycheck because the Democrats walked out of the meeting at the House and left the Capitol before all the work was done. So he's canceled their paycheck. And some news came out from the Catholic bishops, the U.S. bishops in the United States. They have decided and to vote to ban Joe Biden and other communists from receiving communion within the Catholic Church because they are promoting the death of babies and children to such a degree that it's got their attention now, finally. Now we're going into the category of communist racism. Here's the thing that I have found in my almost 70 years of life so far, is that racists are generally black or Democrats or both, and their persuasion now is that of communists. So until I can figure out a different title for this category, it'll be commie racism. 11 cities have moved to start paying money to the blacks there as reparations. Now, none of these cities ever had slaves, so it's guaranteed that these are all communist-controlled cities. And there are other communists out there. See, I use the term communist to cover Democrats because the Democrat Party is gone. They have taken on the color of enemy, and the enemy to the United States are communists, and that's what they are. They're communists. There's other cities right now that they're testing universal basic income. So if you're black and your family earns less than $48,000 in a year, they're going to give you $500 a month, no strings attached. And you wonder, and I can have 50 examples of what I'm going to give you now. Daytona Beach law enforcement officer shot in the head by a black guy. Doctoral candidate, and this is a female. This is one of these liberal, psychotically communistic females who sought to prove justice system was racist against blacks, was walking in an area of blacks, and a black came out and stabbed her to death. South Carolina arrested two black men. These two guys were in a park, in a gas station, and they were caught basically doing drugs or selling drugs and then fighting against the cops, and so the police arrested them. I don't care if they were white, black, green, or red. Well, there's riots outside the police station. A new math workbook comes out that claims it's racist to ask black students to give the right answer. I'm not going to keep going on this. Again, there's another 50 of blacks murdering whites, blacks murdering each other, blacks robbing old women, blacks doing this, blacks doing that, blacks being so stupid as to tell a cop to go screw himself and then getting tased and going down like a wet bag of noodles. There's so many of them. Why? And it's blacks doing this. The white people aren't doing it. They're not that stupid. The blacks are doing it because they've been so emboldened and so empowered by this psychosis, this communist group called Black Lives Matter, and the Democrats pushing the fact that whites aren't worth crap and blacks are gods. There is this thing, you've heard me mention critical race theory before. It's way worse than you can ever imagine. Any of you out there have children in any school, Catholic, Christian, private, public, it doesn't matter. The critical race theory is infected all of them.
Critical race theory is everywhere. It's rapidly becoming the new orthodoxy in America's public institutions, and yet most Americans have no idea where it comes from and what kind of society it envisions. I'll walk through the history of critical race theory, explain why it's a threat to the country, and most importantly, show you how you can fight it. Let's start at the beginning, with a short history of Marxism. Traditionally, the Marxist left has built its political program on the theory of class conflict. Marx believed that the primary mechanism of power in society was the relationship between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. The solution to this conflict, according to Marx, was revolution. He believed the proletariat would eventually gain consciousness of its plight, seize the means of production, and usher in a new socialist society. Over the course of the 20th century, a number of regimes attempted Marxist revolution, and all of them ended in disaster. The socialist countries racked up a body count of nearly 100 million people sent to the gulag, murdered in the streets, or starved to death due to the failure of socialist agricultural policy. Marx envisioned the new man who would transcend the limitations of the industrial world, but in practice, his ideas unleashed man's oldest and darkest brutalities. By the mid-1960s, Marxist intellectuals in Europe and the United States had begun to understand these failures. They recoiled at the tyranny of the Soviet Union and came to realize that the call for the proletarian revolution would never work in the industrial nations of the West, which had large middle classes and a rapidly growing standard of living. Most Americans believed they could transcend their origins through education, hard work, and community support. But rather than abandon their political project, the Marxist scholars of the era, calling themselves critical theorists, simply updated their theory of the revolution. They set out in search of another entry point for their politics and found it in the social and racial unrest of the 1960s. Over the course of the decade, the critical theorists gradually abandoned the old economic dialectic of bourgeoisie and proletariat and replaced it with a new racial dialectic of white and black. This provided the ideological basis for the radical movements of the era, including the Communist Party USA, the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, and the Weather Underground. The vision of the critical theorists and the racial revolutionaries, however, eventually lost out to the vision of the Civil Rights Movement and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, which promised the fulfillment of the American ideal of equality under the law and to alleviate poverty through government action. The radicals sought to overthrow the American regime, but most Americans simply wanted to improve it. But this, too, was destined for disappointment on the left. In the following 30 years, the left became disillusioned with the idea of equality under the law and with the anti-poverty program of the Great Society, which failed to reduce poverty and social pathologies despite trillions in public spending. For many of the intellectuals on the left, the entire project of colorblindness, meritocracy, private property, and individual rights came to be seen as a failure. So they went back to the drawing board and increasingly sought to revive the most radical strands of Marxist thought from the previous generation. This is where critical race theory comes in. Critical race theory is an academic discipline that came to fruition in the 1990s, building on the intellectual framework of critical theory and identity politics. Sometimes it's directly labeled critical race theory, but it's usually deployed under a series of euphemisms, such as equity, social justice, diversity and inclusion, and culturally responsive teaching. This is deliberate. The critical race theorists are masters of language construction and realize that neo-Marxism would be a hard sell to the American public. But equity is soft, persuasive, non-threatening, and easily confused with the American principle of equality. But the distinction between these two words, equality and equity, is vast and crucially important. Equality is the idea that was first proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence, consecrated in blood during the Civil War, and codified into law with the 14th and 15th Amendments, and the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of the mid-1960s. But the critical race theorists explicitly reject this vision, arguing that equality under the law is camouflage for white supremacy, patriarchy, and naked racial oppression. In their academic work, they've directly attacked the principles of non-discrimination, colorblindness, individual rights, private property, school integration, freedom of speech, and meritocracy. The critical race theorists would replace the system of equality with a system of equity, which represent diametrically opposed philosophies. Whereas equality seeks to protect individual rights regardless of race, equity seeks to divide the world into competing racial groups and ensure race-based equality of outcomes, endorsing active racial discrimination to get there. In a foundational paper called Whiteness as Property, the critical race theorist Cheryl Harris has proposed suspending private property rights, seizing land and wealth from the rich, and redistributing it along racial lines. The critical race guru Ibram Kendi has proposed the creation of a Department of Anti-Racism with the power to nullify, veto, or abolish any law at any level of government and silence the speech of political leaders and intellectuals who are not deemed anti-racist. The new department would be unaccountable to voters, the executive, or the legislature. In other words, it would become an all-powerful fourth branch of government and mean the end of the federalist system. Finally, like the critical theorists before them, the critical race theorists would abolish the economic system of capitalism and replace it with an economic system of collectivism. According to Kendi, in order to truly be anti-racist, you also have to truly be anti-capitalist. Identity is the means, Marxism is the end, same as it ever was. So how does this ideology translate into real-world practice? For the first two decades, critical race theory remained an obscure field of inquiry, relegated to academic journals and university campuses. But today, critical race theory is quickly becoming the default ideology of our public institutions. It's spread from the universities to government agencies, public school systems, teacher training programs, and even corporate HR departments. It's been transformed from a series of academic concepts into diversity training programs, corporate compliance modules, public policy frameworks, and public school curricula. Last year, I conducted a series of reports focused on agencies of the federal government. I discovered that the FBI was holding workshops on intersectionality theory. The Department of Homeland Security was telling white employees they were committing micro-inequities and had been socialized into oppressor roles. Finally, the Sandia National Laboratories, which designs America's nuclear arsenal, sent white male executives to a three-day re-education camp, telling them that white male culture was analogous to the KKK, white supremacists, and mass killings. This year, I finished another series of reports focused on critical race theory in education. The stories are shocking. In Cupertino, California, an elementary school forced third graders to deconstruct their racial and sexual identities, then rank themselves according to their power and privilege. In Springfield, Missouri, a middle school forced teachers to locate themselves on an oppression matrix, telling straight, white, English-speaking Christian males they were members of the oppressor class and must atone for their covert white supremacy. In Philadelphia, an elementary school forced fifth graders to celebrate black communism and simulate a black power rally to free Angela Davis from prison, where she had once been held on charges of murder. And finally, in Seattle, the school district told white teachers they were guilty of spirit murder against black children and must bankrupt their privilege in acknowledgement of their thieved inheritance. This is a revolutionary change. In the previous century, state institutions were presented as neutral, technocratic, and oriented towards broadly held perceptions of the public good. This is no longer the case. Our institutions are being radicalized by critical race theory, and the levers of state power are being turned against the American people, with no sign of slowing down. Here's the problem. Thus far, Americans of good faith have been unable to resist critical race theory's blitz through our institutions. There are four main reasons for this. First, most Americans have developed an acute fear of speaking about sensitive social and political issues, especially race. According to a recent Gallup poll, 52% of liberals, 64% of moderates, and 77% of conservatives are scared to share their political beliefs in public. They're afraid to get mobbed on social media, fired from their job, or berated by the institutions. So they simply remain quiet, which cedes the territory to the most intolerant voices who can dominate the public conversation and install their ideology in the country's schools, government agencies, and corporations. And consequently, these institutions become monocultures. Dogmatic, intolerant, suspicious, and hostile to a diversity of beliefs. The Equity and Inclusion Department is established in the name of a social good, but in practice serves as a political office, enforcing the new orthodoxy and punishing any dissent. Second, the critical race theorists have constructed their argument like a mousetrap. They claim that any disagreement with their program is simply evidence of the dissenters' white fragility, unconscious bias, or internalized white supremacy. They project this idea of false consciousness on all of their opponents. They transform principled disagreement into evidence of guilt. I've seen this play out dozens of times in my reporting. Diversity trainers will make an outrageous claim, such as all whites are intrinsically oppressors, or white teachers are guilty of spirit murdering black children, and then flat out refuse to consider any evidence to the contrary. If they're confronted, they'll adopt a tone of patronizing concern and explain that participants are feeling white denial and reacting out of guilt and shame. The dissenters are instructed to remain silent, lean into the discomfort, and accept their complicity in white supremacy. Thus, the mousetrap is shut and the program continues without interruption. Third, many liberals, moderates, and conservatives have failed to separate critical race theory's premise from its conclusion. The premise of critical race theory is quite simple. America has a history of slavery, racism, and injustice, and we should examine the relationship between racism, power, and society. This is undoubtedly true. Nobody taking an honest look at American history could deny it. But the critical race theorist's conclusion that the American regime is irredeemably racist and must be overthrown through moral, political, and economic revolution is false. But the critical race theorists use their premise as a bludgeon, bullying people into accepting their conclusions. This is dishonest and manipulative. It's entirely logical and moral to accept the premise that the United States has a history of racial injustice, and even that residual racism is still a pernicious force in American society, but reject the critical race theorist political program, which, as we've seen, is little more than repackaged 1960s-style Marxism. Finally, the writers and activists who've had the courage to speak out against critical race theory have often fought on purely theoretical terms, pointing out critical race theory's flawed logic, internal contradictions, and bad history. These are all worthy criticisms, but they move the debate into the realm of the academic and the abstract, which is friendly terrain for the critical race theorists and absolves them from grappling with the practical and tangible consequences of their philosophy. We shouldn't challenge the critical race theorists to debate the finer points of Marx and Marcuse. We must confront them with the reality that they're creating. Do they support schools separating third graders into oppressor and oppressed? Do they support a curriculum teaching that all white people perpetuate systemic racism? Do they support schools instructing white parents to become white traitors and advocate for white abolition? Do they believe that counter-genocide is a solution to America's problems? These are all real-world examples from my investigative reporting and a better challenge to critical race theory than 1,000 academic papers. The real test for the critical race theorists is not to defend their ideas as abstractions, but to defend the real-world impact of their ideas. And this brings us to the key point. Critical race theory is no longer a phenomenon of the mind. It's a phenomenon of political power. If we want to successfully oppose this new orthodoxy, we must seek to change the structures that have enabled it into being. We must address politics as politics and confront power as power. So this is the task, to defeat the ideology of critical race theory and reassert the American ideals of freedom and equality. There are four ways we can accomplish this: public policy, civil rights lawsuits, grassroots mobilization, and winning the public debate. First, we can and must fight critical race theory in the domain of public policy. And in fact, we're already doing this. Last year, my reporting led President Trump to issue an executive order banning critical race theory-based training programs from the federal government. President Biden rescinded this order on his first day in office, but it provided a model for red state governors and legislators who want to protect their citizens from race essentialism, collective guilt, and neo-segregation. Governor Ron DeSantis has banned critical race theory in Florida's K-12 curriculum, and red states have introduced bills to achieve the same goal through legislation. Second, we must fight against critical race theory in the courts. To do this, I've launched a new legal coalition to stop public institutions from conducting programs that stereotype, scapegoat, or demean people on the basis of race. Our argument is that critical race theory is not only intellectually and morally bankrupt, but in practice violates existing law. It violates the First Amendment, which protects citizens from compelled speech, the 14th Amendment, which provides equal protection under the law, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits public institutions from discriminating on the basis of race. Eventually, one of our cases will reach the Supreme Court and we'll win. Third, there's a bipartisan and multiracial coalition that's emerging to fight critical race theory at the grassroots level. Parents have begun fighting against racially divisive curricula in schools, and employees have begun speaking out against Orwellian practices in the workplace. Asian American parents in particular have been successful in pushing back at the local level. They've recognized that critical race theory poses a major threat to their children, categorizing them as oppressors, discriminating against them in college admissions, and punishing their success. In my reporting, many Chinese Americans told me that they survived the Cultural Revolution in their home country and refused to let it happen here in America. Finally, we must develop a new moral language on these issues and appeal to higher principles than our opponents. We must promote the true story of America, a story that is honest about injustices in our history, but places them in the context of our nation's highest ideals and the progress we've made towards realizing them. We must raise the debate to a higher level. For example, we often find ourselves debating about diversity. Diversity is good, all things being equal, but it's a secondary value. We should really be aiming towards excellence, which provides a common standard and challenges people of all backgrounds to achieve their true potential. When we elevate the debate to this higher conceptual plane, we force our opponents to debate on our territory. And excellence beats diversity every time. The stakes of this fight are incredibly high. It's not an exaggeration to say that a governing regime based on critical race theory would mean the end of freedom and equality in America. According to their own policy prescriptions, the critical race theorists would limit or abolish the right to private property, freedom of speech, equal protection under the law, non-discrimination, free enterprise, and the federalist system of government. In its place, they would create a new regime of group-based rights, race-based redistribution of wealth, omnipotent bureaucratic authority, and active racial discrimination. It's not a program of reform. It's a program of revolution that rejects the founding principles and would overturn the premise of the Constitution. The secret to winning this fight is courage. This is the fundamental virtue required of our time. The courage to speak the truth. The courage to withstand epithets. The courage to face the mob. When enough of us do this, when we break through the wall of fear that prevents so many people from speaking out, the narrative of critical race theory will begin to crumble. It's easy to stop a lone dissenter. It's much more difficult to stop 10, 20, 100, 1,000, a million people who stand up together. Truth and justice are on our side. If we can muster the courage, we will win.
And you can see all over the internet where these non-elected school boards, these are, they call themselves voluntary. School boards all over the United States have been infested with communists. This is how they do it. The communists get into the water boards, city councils, the economic advisory committees, the education board, okay? These people are pushing their communist agenda, and they're getting away with it because people aren't standing up, or at least they weren't standing up. Right now, you can go all over the internet, and you will find dozens and dozens and dozens of mothers and fathers and uncles and even children that are going through this, and you'll find them standing up and telling the truth, which these boards of education don't want to hear.
Hi, my name is Brad Taylor, and I just finished my freshman year at RHS. I've been a part of District 196 schools now for 10 years, and I'm going to give you a glimpse today of what's actually going on inside these schools. Despite the board's attempt to deny it, District 196 schools are quickly becoming a place where promoting activism is actually more important than promoting education. I'll take you back to my first day at RHS this fall. The principal came out and gave us a heartfelt speech about equality and standing together. He began to list countless races, such as Latino, Asian, expressing how much they matter and how important they are. But never once did he mention a race or identity that reflects me, or half the kids that were in the class. Now, members of the board, I know you haven't been to school in a while. I know none of you, or most of you, don't have any kids left in the school district, but you must admit how uncomfortable it will be to be characterized just by your skin color on the first day of school, and be thought that you were wrong just because of your skin color. So I'll never forget the look one of my friends gave me from across the room as we were sitting there listening to this blatant bias being expressed in the so-called equity statement by the leader of our school. To be clear, I don't need you to tell me that I matter, but hearing the condolences given to other races and leaving just one race out, it inevitably you'll start to feel like you've done something wrong. And in our principal's attempt to unify us, he instead created unwarranted boundaries and barriers between his students, pitting us against each other based on characteristics that we can't control. In another separate instance, I was told that writing "All Lives Matter" on the whiteboard was political and could be seen as offensive. When I questioned the teacher after class, she told me that she didn't have an answer and she just had to erase it, and it was quickly erased. There are political signs all over RHS, about specific races that matter, specific sexual orientations that matter, and specific perspectives that matter. But when I questioned the RHS administration about how these signs were political, they told me that they were supporting human rights. So when I questioned why the equity statement couldn't represent all students, they told me that to even ask that question was outlandish and offensive. When I asked why that was, they told me, quote, "whites have a pretty good situation right now," unquote. So is that not racism? Disregarding my question merely because of the color of my skin. To be honest, after enduring a year of the people in charge telling me that I'm a racist and I'm privileged and pointing out our irreversible differences, I've never noticed race more, and it's becoming the first thing I notice when I meet someone, which has never before been the case. RHS administration confidently told me that RHS students and staff are happy with their equity statement, But from my experience in talking with other students, this is not the case. I know many kids who disagree with their teachers, but they're too scared to stand up because they're worried that their grades will be docked and their learning experience will be affected. My honors government teacher, I'm not going to say his name, but he's mentioned that Democrats care more about all people while Republicans only care about themselves. And he's also inferred to us that socialism is better than democracy. He had a statue of a socialist leader in his classroom. I've been told by a lot of kids that they just stay silent and adjust their schoolwork to reflect an acceptable opinion to secure a good grade. I've been approached by multiple teachers who have told me in private that they just want to say that they agree with me and they support me standing up, but they can't say it in front of the class for fear of being disciplined by the administration in some way or losing their jobs. There is clearly only one way to think in this district, and that is that they are teaching their kids to shut up if they don't agree. Now, members of the board, I want you to take a good look at yourselves in the mirror tonight and ask, are you really standing up for the equality of all people? Or are you just pushing a damaging political ideology on our students? A fellow coworker at my job, who by the way is of color, discreetly told me that the school seemed to be pushing a very leftist agenda in class. This proved that not everyone is happy with your school, and not everyone who isn't happy is white. Now, due to all these instances I've mentioned and many more that I can't fit in this 5-minute speech, I have decided to leave this district and continue school on a private Christian school online. And there will be sacrifices, and I will not get to walk in the graduation ceremony or attend milestones at RHS, but I will be able to learn in an environment that is not intent on punishing me daily for my skin color and political views. Now, regardless of how you take my speech, whether you just shrug it off as malarkey or Fox News talking points, I encourage you to think about it, because someday I'm going to be a leader. I may be the president, a governor, or just a professional golfer, but I will never stop believing that everybody has value, no matter their skin color or personal beliefs, and it's a shame that you're not going to be able to say that I was an alumni of RHS in District 196. Thank you.
This critical race theory, this CRT, basically all it is, and they have many different words and different ways to flower it up, but basically all it is saying how whites are evil, whites have destroyed the world, whites are going to continue destroying the world, and whites need to be controlled, and they need to understand how evil and bad they are. This is the basic, okay? And this is what your children are being taught right now. And this crap is in our military. And this is why I am so worried about this country. Our military, as far as I can see right now, is toast if we get hit with a real altercation. Not with a bunch of Muslims running in the sand and holding their AKs above their arms and going and shooting in the air. That's not a real enemy. When Russia decides to kick our butt, or when China decides to kick our butt, or when, for that matter, anyone decides to kick our butt, military isn't going to be worth a damn. Some of the equipment might be, but the military won't be. It's going to be the citizens in the United States that are going to be keeping and protecting the United States, because the military is just too damn woke.
Hi, I'm with the U.S. military, and I identify as a 4-star general. Lately, things around here have gotten a little more woke, and we've done nothing but get more powerful as a result. We found that solely focusing on national defense was interfering with the military's goal of diversity, so we've worked hard to help turn that around. Without enough inclusivity and diversity, being on the battlefield taking heavy fire just isn't a safe space. We feel a powerful step in national security for our country is indoctrinating the military with woke principles that ultimately stem from hatred for our country. Let me tell you about all our exciting improvements. Now that the military has gone woke, combat leaders will no longer be selected based on operational excellence, technical proficiency, leadership integrity, agility, or trained lethality. Instead, they'll be selected based on race and gender. We're proud to say our Special Forces teams are now the most diverse Special Forces units on the planet. Each unit is comprised of the ideal tactical diversity ratio of 10% white, 10% black, 10% Hispanic, 10% Asian, 10% gay, 10% bi, 10% trans, 10% paraplegic, 10% quadriplegic, and 10% severely mentally handicapped. I have never once seen any evidence that strong, aggressive men who love our country and who are highly trained at inflicting violence are any more effective on the battlefield than anyone else. Woke politicians in Washington who have never been on the battlefield have determined that critical race theory is important for our soldiers to be indoctrinated into. Now the military includes critical race theory works on its reading list. One book on the list is by Abraham Kennedy. He says that the only remedy for past discrimination is present discrimination. It's kind of like he's innovated and realized two wrongs do make a right. Luckily, the military is dedicated to ending discrimination by implementing discrimination through critical race theory. So now in life or death situations, we'll have more division between races and hopefully some resentment. Unity is the last thing you want when persons are putting their lives on the line. And instead of fighting a common enemy, what happens when you start fighting each other a little bit? We're going to find out. A few of the upcoming strategies we'll be implementing to further improve our military are, we'll be rebranding Green Berets as Rainbow Berets. Snipers will now be required to ask their targets to identify their chosen pronouns prior to shooting so that they may be killed in a safe space. Only be going after foreign terrorists who are white. Going after any other type of terrorist who's plotting to kill Americans would obviously be racist. And that's something we don't want to perpetuate, according to our critical race theory tactics. And we'll further be expanding our inclusivity and equality by adopting strategies that have proven to be successful in Little League sports. Like now, everyone will get a turn flying a fighter jet. We were finding that privileged pilot training was rooted in a discriminatory system whereby if someone wasn't qualified to be a pilot, they weren't allowed to be a pilot. Now moving forward, every Navy SEAL team must be made up of 50% men, 50% women, and 50% gender-fluid living entities. We've proven through politically correct science that a person's strength has no correlation to how strong they are. Thus, women who can't lift as much are just as strong as men who can lift more because of equality. The idea that men are better suited to carry 80-pound rucks and 210-pound wounded soldiers on their backs over rugged terrain is simply a myth rooted in centuries of toxic masculinity. Strength is just a social construct. Everybody's strong enough. Today, we're permanently replacing hand-to-hand combat training with hand-holding training. It'll instill more emotional sensitivity in our soldiers to give them more resiliency when words are weaponized. The leader of identity politics, our commander-in-chief himself, President Biden, has recently informed the world that the greatest threat against our military is climate change. Nothing political there, just actual warfare knowledge. Accordingly, we'll no longer be equipping our soldiers with outdated guns. Instead, we'll be equipping them with both warm clothes and cool clothes to help them survive against the weather. Here's a woke military question for you. Say you're in a firefight with dangerous radicals in Afghanistan. Are you allowed to shoot back? Absolutely not, because that would be uninclusive and racist, because they're not white. Instead, just take the bullets. And as you and your team are laying there dying, just ask yourself this question. How could we have prevented all this through more inclusivity? And finally, with our special forces, we've eliminated all fitness and technical proficiency requirements as we found they were uninclusive for the people who couldn't meet them. And for the record, no, there's no negative ramifications on the battlefield, okay? Hey, where'd all those caskets come from?
And now we're going to talk about something else, something that we at Survival Enterprises sell. If you go to survivalenterprises.com or se1.us, Samuel Edwards, the numeral 1.us, on the left-hand side, you'll see links, home, site map, how to buy from us, about us, healthcare. Click on healthcare. And that'll take you to, basically, this is all the stuff we sell, and it's in a one giant roll down. It gives you the ability to look at everything once and scroll down. Most of it's alphabetical. We got a product called colloidal minerals. Now, I want to talk about colloidal minerals because this is something that is necessary in our body. And not just some people's bodies. This is everybody's body.
Colloidal is Latin for in liquid suspension, or basically that, and minerals, because that's what it is. It's minerals that are, for want of a better term, nano-sized. Now, where it comes from, this is a unique formula. This is not something that you can go to Walmart and buy. This is from a mineral deposit in Utah. 100 million years ago, give or take 20, 30 million years, that area of Utah literally looked like the Garden of Eden. It had daisies 100 feet high. The plant life was like astounding. And then Yellowstone went off. Now, it was all covered not by lava, but by dust. That's what it was all covered by. It was all covered by the volcanic dust, and it just pressed it all down. It compressed all of these plants. And then over the millennial, dirt fell on top of them and so forth and so on. What it is, this deposit is this. Plants take inorganic minerals and via photosynthesis turn them into organic minerals. So what you have is this deposit that's hundreds of feet down. It's called humus. No, not humus. That's something else. It's called humus. And it looks like, if you ever gotten any of those sponges, like they look like a dragon or something, and they're so compressed that you could barely see what this thing is, and you add water and it swells up. Well, that's what that deposit looks like. So let me tell you the story. In the 1920s, there was this rancher. His name was Thomas Jefferson Clark, and he was a sickly man. He wasn't that strong. There was Paiute Indians there that he would trade with. He would give them a cow, and they would give him hides and other things. And they became not friends, but tolerated each other. Well, one of these visits of the Indians to him, one of the Indians looked at him and basically said, "You know, you really look like hell. How about you come and you make use of this water that we have further on in our land?" So he went with him, and I'm paraphrasing this all to hell, believe me. He went with him, and they found this spring that was coming out of the side of a hill. And the water was yellow. It didn't look palatable at all. And it tasted like hell. I can tell you that personally because I have tasted it. And they said, bathe in it, drink it as much as you can. So he spent a couple weeks living there alongside that spring. And he was drinking the water and bathing in the water. And his illnesses started to disappear. So he thought that was a hell of a thing. So he bottled up a bunch of it and took it back to his ranch, and he was showing it to some of his friends and his family, and they said, "You know, that sounds like a damn good idea. This stuff, we need to get more of this." So he went back, and he ended up buying that property from the Indians. Now, there's a story saying that it was a Paiute chief or something like that. I have no clue, and they have no verification of it. But he bought the land, and what they would do is they just simply bottle that stuff that was coming out of the side of the mountain. Now, this is in the 20s, so it's in the 20s and 30s, and he was giving it away to his family and friends. And then over time, they figured, you know what, let's start selling this as a tonic. You know, this is during the time there was no really FDA approval for anything like this, and people were selling all kinds of weird tonics and stuff. So he started to sell it. And he was doing pretty good because it actually was working. It's not some of this snake oil stuff that people buy and then it never does anything. Well, this was handling all kinds of problems that people were having. It handled rickets, arthritis, soft bones, eczema, ear infections, easy bruising, frequent bloody nose, immune deficiencies, scabies, migraines, hair loss. Now, this is not a cure for these things. This is just what has been handled by the colloidal minerals over the past 100 years. Not that if you have a throat infection, you should take this and it'll cure it. Even though I have done so. It says it handles weak arterial walls and emphysema. It has handled all kinds of stuff. And I'm not saying it will handle it, but it has handled all kinds of stuff in different people. Now, most of the people that take this, they take it because they want the energy. This actually gives them energy. If you look at plants and the land that the plants are grown in, and you can see this, you can even find an article, and I already have, and I just didn't get it, came out this week, that we've lost the top soil in the United States. And now when farmers plant, they actually have to hire people to come in and spray minerals into their plants. Well, you're not getting any minerals. And that's what this is for. You take an ounce of it a day, and I take mine in orange juice, and then that's it. And it does all kinds of stuff. It just depends on what your body needs. If nothing else, it gives you the minerals that your body needs. What they do now is they dig down, and they dig up some of this humus. And they take it, and they take it, and they put it in stainless steel tanks, and they use triple distilled water they put in there, and they seep out all of the minerals. So remember, what you're getting are organic minerals, plant-based minerals. Some companies call it trace minerals. The original Thomas Jefferson Clark, it's still in their family. And the company's name is called Hub Research. You'll find nothing about it. They do not sell to the public. They sell to five companies worldwide, and I'm one of them. So this is the real one. Now, there's a lot of multi-level marketing con artists out there. And they take this, they have other companies that are manufacturing their minerals, and they call them colloidal minerals or trace minerals or some other thing like that. They are not the original. They flavor them up, they add a bunch of weird crap to them, and then they charge you like you wouldn't believe. Well, this stuff is astounding. We have people who do aquaculture. I got one guy who does aquaculture in a greenhouse. He is growing plants, and then below the plants, he's raising fish. And he puts a gallon of this in that system, the water system, pretty much once a month. We have another lady she raises miniature ponies of some kind. I don't know what the name of the horse is, but it looks to me like a long-tailed German Shepherd. That's what it looks like. And they are famous for rickets and for mineral deficiencies. Since she's been using these, our colloidal minerals, and she's been using them for over 20 years, no problems whatsoever with her horses. And we have people who raise plants, specific herbs, and they use this in their water. They'll put, like in a gallon of water, they'll put maybe an ounce of the colloidal minerals. There's all kinds of different uses. You know, Survival Enterprises sells all kinds of interesting things. The thing is, you guys, when you buy this stuff, we never know what you're going to do with it. We have a woman who adds it to a shampoo, and it washes you. That's not the only ingredient in it, but she adds it to another shampoo, and she sells it. And it washes your hair so clean, it's astounding. We have people who simply put an ounce of it in a quart of water, and after they've washed their hair, they rinse their hair with it, and it cleans it squeaky clean. We have people who give it to their animals, cats, dogs, lizards, snakes, and, whatever that you guys, like I said, you do all kinds of weird stuff with this. But these are organic minerals. There are minerals out there you can buy in capsule size and pill size and other liquid stuff. And all they are, they're inorganic minerals that are put in there. And your body, if you get 1,000 milligrams of inorganic magnesium, your body out of that is going to probably pull about 100 milligrams that it can use. So you want the organic minerals, and that's what colloidal minerals are. Now, we've been selling this for 30 years. You will not get toxic metal buildup in your body by taking this stuff because they're organic. And this is the thing that will freak you out. When you look at the side of the bottle, it'll tell you all of the minerals that are in there. Now, they're in various amounts. Because of this is organic, there's no way we can give it an exact dose of what's in there. But you're going to find fluoride. You're going to find aluminum. You're going to find all kinds of minerals in there. You want to have organic minerals. And obviously, I want you to buy them from me because we have the cheapest price in the United States. How we got into this 30 years ago, Survival Enterprise has been in business almost 40 years. 30 years ago, we had a woman who was buying products from us, and she was a really nice lady, and I was buying these colloidal minerals from her for my own use, and they were too expensive at the time to buy them and then turn around and resell them. She wouldn't sell them wholesale. Well, she calls me up one day and she goes, "I'm going to do you a big favor." And I'm like, "Okay, what?" Well, she tells me how she just invented a two-part epoxy that soaks into concrete and waterproofs concrete. I said, "Well, that's neat. So why do I care about that?" She goes, "Well, you don't need to. I sold the patent to the Japanese government, and they want me to go to Japan, and they're going to pay me $100,000 a year to run the plant. So I'm going to give you my colloidal mineral business." And then she put us in contact with the Clark family. I mean, we've been selling them now since then. These are vital. Everyone should have these. It's not that expensive, for crying out loud. If you buy a quart, it's only $15. And again, we got the best prices in the United States. There is no one that comes close. But what we have on sale right now, because I'm going to put these on sale, the gallon is normally $45. We're putting them on sale for $40. I know that's not much, but a gallon for $40, you will not come close to that anywhere in the United States. If you're interested, you go to survivalenterprises.com, SE1.us, and you go to health department there. You'll find colloidal minerals. You'll find it says they're on sale. You buy them. Or you can call us at 800-753-1981. That's 800-753-1981. Order that way, and you get a gallon of colloidal minerals for $40. Okay, that's it for today. I hope I gave you some information, and I hope I entertained you. And keep us in business. Buy some colloidal minerals. This is the Armchair Survivalist signing off. Keep your nose in the air and your ear to the ground. Pay attention.